past few weeks, we've been discussing the difficulty that Avram and Sarah have had in fulfilling the dream which God has given them. Already beginning with Parshas Lech Lecha, we are told that Avram and Sarah are commanded by God to leave their land, Be'eskel Agoy Gadol, and they will give rise to a great nation. God tells them it will be a nation that is committed to the Jewish belief, to the Jewish heritage. It is a nation which is committed to the ideal of Eretz Yisrael, of the land of Israel. But yet we've seen so far that realizing this dream has not at all been an easy task. Avraham asked that he be blessed with children, and this was most difficult. For years they didn't have children, and Avraham and Sarah were afraid that all of their efforts would not be realized. At the time of their death, there would be no one to pass their message to a future generation. Finally, the Torah tells us that Yitzchak is born, and then in Parshas Vayera we find that God commands Avraham to sacrifice Yitzchak, and the amazing willingness on his behalf to do so, even though again he realized that this would mean the end of his dream, and the end of that, again he realized that this would mean the end of his dream, and the end of that which he has tried so hard to achieve through his life. Finally, it seems that we have a break. We can pause and have a sigh of relief because the Akedas Yitzchak did not take place. Yitzchak is spared. Vayelchu Shneihem Yachdav, they're able to leave the place of the Akedah. And yet we finally realize at the beginning of last week's parsha, Chayin Sarah, that they finally return to their home only to realize that Sarah has just died. So this, the Ramban points out, was also a tremendous test. What a difficult task it was for Avram to realize that the dream that he has always had, that he and his wife Sarah together can give rise to a Jewish nation, would not really occur. At this point, he would have to go at it alone, without anyone to be able to give him that support and to share in his dream. And even the Ramban points out, as I mentioned last week, the simple task of burial was so difficult for Avraham. He was promised that everywhere that he would walk within the land of Israel would be his, and yet he wasn't even able to secure a small piece of land for Kvura, for the burial of his wife. He has to go to the king, to Ephron, and tell him, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, I am a stranger, I don't have any land at this moment, please give it to me. And he's obligated to purchase it bekesef malei at a very high price. He didn't question. Avram didn't turn to God and say, all I'm trying to do is fulfill your word, and yet you're making it so difficult for me. But rather, he fulfilled each commandment as God gave it to him. Then he realizes that there's another task that he has to fulfill. In order to assure the continuity of the generations, it's not enough that Yitzchak be saved from sacrifice from the Akedah, but it's necessary that he be married in order to be able to foster a subsequent generation that can perpetuate this belief. And we discussed last week, what was it that Avram felt Yitzchak should be looking for? What type of wife would be necessary in order to be able to foster a generation of people committed to his ideals? And finally, when you reach the end of last week's parsha of Chayei Sarah, you get the feeling that things are now on a roll. They finally reached a point where Yitzchak is married. Finally, Yishmael is out of the picture. And now Yitzchak, together with Rivka, can foster that type of generation that Avram and Sarah were able to do with their son Yitzchak. And yet, you find at the beginning of the Kriyas HaTorah, Parshas Toldos, that even this will be a most difficult task. The Torah tells us that for years it was very difficult for Yitzchak and Rivka to have children. And finally they're able to do so. Their hope, their dream, was that they would not have the same conflicts that Yitzchak had. Avram had two sons. He had Yitzchak and he had Yishmael. And the Torah had to tell us that even though he had both sons, ki the Yitzchak yikar lecha zera, that the Zera Avraham, the true descendant and disciple of Abraham, would not be both of his children, but would only be the son Yitzchak. Yitzchak and Rivka hoped and prayed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that this conflict that Yitzchak had with his brother should not be a conflict that he would have to go through with his children, or that his children would have to see among themselves. And yet, the Torah tells us it was most difficult. Rivka was expecting, and Vayisrotitzu habanim bekirba. All of a sudden she noticed that there was some strife, there was some tension, as if there was an inner conflict, even before her children were born, from the moment of conception, between the two sons that she was carrying. With this, much of their dream was shattered. They had hoped that at least in their generation they would see some unity that Avram was unable to see. And as we know, the same conflict that you find with Yitzchak and Ishmael repeats itself with the conflict of the children of Yitzchak, with Yaakov and Esau. And the Gemara actually tells us that even Avraham was made aware of this. For after all, when God promises him he will have a child, ki v'yitzchak yikar lecha zera, I will give you a son, and through him your message will be transmitted and perpetuated to future generations. But the Gemara is bothered by a simple phrase. The Torah doesn't say ki yitzchak yikar lecha zera. It doesn't say that Yitzchak will give rise to the Jewish nation. The Torah tells us ki v'yitzchak yikar lecha zera, that through a part of Yitzchak, through some of the descendants of Yitzchak, that is where the Jewish nation will be fostered. So even Avraham, our sages tell us, was aware of this. Avraham knew that the conflict that he had with his children would not end in that generation, but it is something that would last at least for another generation, that not all of the descendants of Yitzchak would be the ones who would follow in the ways of Yitzchak or of their grandfather Avraham, but only ki bi Yitzchak. Some would, but others would not. This was a shattering realization that Yitzchak and Rivka had to face. Vayisrotitzu habanim bekirba, that Rivka realized that something was wrong. And what do you do when something is wrong? Trying to figure out what the solution is. The Torah tells us, Vatelech lidros es Hashem. When a person senses that something is just not right, when a person finds that there's a certain struggle, you know, conflict or emptiness in their life, the only way to adequately resolve it is Vatelech lidros es Hashem. The solution is to try to become closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to seek counsel, to seek advice from those people who you feel will be able to most adequately and most articulately express what is it that the Torah requires. This was a twofold response that Rivka had. She sought out what was it that was happening to her, and she dived into HaKadosh Baruch Hu that the situation should change. And the response which she was given was Shnei Goyim Bevitznev. The struggle that you're sensing is a real one, because the struggle that you feel even at this moment before birth is a struggle of two nations which you and your husband Yitzchak will give rise to. It is true that the message of Avram will be perpetuated through you, but not through all of your descendants. You will have a Yitzchak, you will have a Yaakov, and Yaakov will give rise to a Jewish nation, but you will also have an Esau who will not follow in these ways. And Rivka was told that she shouldn't think that this will just be a conflict that will last a generation. This is Shnei Goyim Bevitznev. The conflict that you find between Yaakov and Esau is one which will span the generations. It will be one of conflict between those that believe in the ideals which you subscribe to, and those who do not. And it's not going to be an easy task to be able to try to build a nation based on the Birchas Avraham, the blessings and the ideals which you have and which your father has had. It was for them a shattering revelation. They realized that Avram came from very little. They understood that if you don't have a certain background, it's understandable how some children will follow in your ways and other children will not. Just because Avram decided at a given time that he believed in God did not necessarily ensure that this would be true of his children. But Yitzchak felt a generation later, after the religion has gotten off the ground, after a time where it's been developed, where his children not only had parents, but had grandparents as well, that the task would be easier. And the Torah informs us that it's very, very difficult. The difficulty of raising a complete Jewish home is a challenge which faced Avraham, challenge which faced Yitzchak, and the Gemara tells us the only one who was truly successful in raising this type of home was Yaakov, together with his wives Rachel and Leah. The real Kiso Shalem, the bracha that all of the descendants would follow in the path of the Torah, was not something that Avram, a bracha that he was able to receive. It wasn't a bracha that Yitzchak received. It was only a bracha that Yaakov had. That's why that the name of Yaakov was changed to be the name of Yisrael, because that can't be said of Avraham and Yitzchak. Avram had different children, some of whom followed in his ways. Kiv Yitzchak Ikari Lachazera, Yitzchak also had an Esav. He didn't only have a Yaakov. The greatness of Yaakov was his ability to foster a complete family, all of whom subscribed and all of whom fought for this belief. It's interesting, the Meshech Chachma points out a most profound comment. You find that it was so important for Avraham not only to transmit the message to his immediate family, but to try to transmit the message of Judaism to the entire world. V'yasa nefesh aserasu b'charam, Rashi tells us, means that Avraham was megayer the anoshim, Sarah was megayer es the anoshim, that Avraham and Sarah together waged an active campaign to try to get the nations of the world to convert. And the Gemara tells us this is true of Yitzchak as well. Yitzchak wasn't merely satisfied with the immediate family and satisfying their needs, but they tried to seek out others as well, other people who will join and become part of the Jewish heritage. Regarding Yaakov, this wasn't so. The Torah tells us in Parshas Vayishlach that when Yaakov set up camp, Vayichanes Pnei Ha'ir. Vayichanes Pnei Ha'ir means that he set up boundaries. When Yitzchak planted in a certain area and his family dwelled there, then he set up a certain boundary. And the Medrash tells us that Vayichan es Pnei Ha'ir means that Yaakov Avinu set up tumim. He set up certain limitations. There is a halacha on Shabbos that a person is not allowed to walk more than 2,000 amos outside of the city. So this, the Medrash tells us, was instituted by Yaakov. Vayichan es Pnei Ha'ir meant that when Yaakov set up camp, he was able to say that this is where we are dwelling and no further. And the Meshech Chachma asks, why was that so? Why was the practice of Yaakov so drastically different than that of Avram and Yitzchak? That Avram and Yitzchak on the one hand seemed to attempt to disseminate their message to an entire nation as a whole. Esanefesh Ashrasu Bukhara means that they went out actively trying to convert people for their cause. When it comes to Yaakov, you see that that's not true. There's no mention in the Torah that he ever did so. And the Medrash tells us, Vayichan es Pnei Ha'ir meant that he set up certain boundaries. The family should stay here. it should not go out and try to have such an impact on other nations. So the Meshech Chachma answers that the points that I've mentioned are related. Avraham saw that his job was to give rise to a new nation. And he realized that it's not something he could do alone. It's something which he had to have other people join him. It wasn't just a nation of himself. It wasn't merely going to be a nation of his child. It was going to be a nation made up of others as well. And as you know, whenever you form a nation or you form an organization or you begin to try to get something off the ground, it's necessary to seek aid. And that's what Avram had to do, and that's what Yitzchak had to do. Yaakov, however, kiso shalem. Yaakov had this tremendous bracha that all of his children followed in his ways. Yaakov was able to foster a nation without attempting to convert others, but merely with emphasizing the importance of his immediate family. And whereas Avraham and Yitzhak would try to persuade others, Yaakov did so to a much lesser extent. He certainly felt the sense of communal responsibility. He certainly shared in the pain of others. But the active response that Avraham and Yitzhak had to try to go out and make the Jewish nation larger, that, the Meshech Chachma points out, that ended with Yaakov. When Yaakov had the ability to foster his nuclear family as a nation, he knew that that nation would grow by itself. If a person wanted to become part of it, they could. But his job was not actively to seek out converts. It's a good question. The Torah doesn't mention anything about them. It's a very good question. It would appear at first glance that the people temporarily became part of the Jewish nation, but then afterwards left. Sodom and Amorah seemed to have been there. That even though Avram had so many people that he converted, they couldn't even get a handful of righteous people in order to save the city. It would appear that these methods were not as successful. Right, you don't find any mention of them. It would appear that Yaakov came to this realization that if you want to have a successful nation and you want to build based on strength of commitment, it has to be an internal one. It doesn't mean you don't allow for conversion. The Gemara says in the fourth parak of Yevamos, when a person comes to convert, you have to make sure that their motives are correct. You have to make sure that the reasons are sincere and that they understand what they're getting themselves into. But certainly, a ger is very welcome in the community. That's certainly an obligation that we have. But the notion that it's our responsibility to proselytize and to go out and try to seek out people who are not Jewish to become Jewish, that Yaakov realized was not the way to build a nation. He saw, as you mentioned, that Avram converted and Yitzhak converted, but the bottom line is, when it came to practice, he was still alone. And the only remnant that you had was Yitzhak with Yaakov and Yaakov's family. Yeah.
With all respect, I question the conclusion that Yaakov was such a successful father, that his family followed him in his ways, because his son, certainly for a long time, were not exactly tzaddikim. And indeed, it makes it quite clear that he disapproves of
There's no doubt, you're certainly right, that family life and to foster family is not easy. And it was certainly full of much conflict. I mean, the envy that you found of Yosef and Binyamin with his other brothers is something we'll have to discuss at length. But there's no doubt that it was a difficult process. And just because you have a Jewish family doesn't make things any easier. Still, the animosity and personal jealousies are certainly there. What just the Gemara does mention is that, normally speaking, when Yaakov had children, all of them were Jewish. All of them became Jews, and all of them followed in the ways of the Torah. They weren't perfect. They made many, many mistakes. This wasn't true of Avraham and Yitzhak. The person had two children. One of them was Jewish. Another one wasn't Jewish. Today, it's unheard of. If a woman has two children, they're either both Jewish or they're both not Jewish. That's true post-Yaakov. Before then, it was possible, God said, that I'm giving you two children, and the message will be only disseminated through one and after the other. So you're right, it wasn't an easy road. And there are many, many problems. The Shivtei Yisrael were far from perfect. But they did have a common belief that you didn't find in the previous generations.
Assuming that eventually Netanyahu would war with God supposedly would be, so they would be. Which came first? In Abraham and Yitzchak, they were so busy trying to convert. Karmically, God doesn't.
It could
concentrate so much on their own.
It could be that, correct, these two differences are not coincidental. It could very well be, even though that this was the divine will, and Avraham was aware of this, and he was aware of what happened to Yitzchak. The lesson that we learn is very true, that when you have a father such as Yaakov, who places his emphasis on the family, as opposed to trying only to save others, then there is a much greater chance that the family will emerge as one. Still be difficult, there'll still be conflicts. When you have parents who are trying to save the world, sometimes their children suffer, right, in that past. Something that you find with Avram, something you find in Yitzhak. Not attempting to imply that this was the fault of Avram or Yitzhak. The Torah tells us that this was the divine will. And Avram already knew, Kiv Yitzhak Ikar Lachazera. There's nothing that Yitzhak could have done. Shnei Goyim Bevitznech, before they were born, he knew he would have an Esav. But yet, there's no doubt that the input that Yaakov had with his children and even with grandchildren, right, were able to give rise to the type of nation and the Shvatim of Yisrael that Yaakov was able to foster.
Wasn't it simplified to Moshe Rabbeinu with his children?
Right, it could very well be. There's very little that you find about the children of Moshe.
No, but on Mishina, he was busy sending God's message, but in the meantime he forgot to circumcise the children, and the model came, he wanted to do
that. Right, we'll have to see why Moshe did that. Right? Why was it that Moshe, so to speak, was, as the Torah seems to say, somewhat lax as far as the meal of his son? The conflict is very real, though. When a person is merely involved with communal service, at times the family suffers as a result. Yaakov knew that if he wanted to make sure that his children would grow up in a certain way, then it meant vayichanas pnei ha'ir, that he had to realize that this is going to be my emphasis. I will emphasize what is right with the family, with others as well, but never at that expense. There was even a further conflict that you find. It wasn't bad enough that Yitzchak and Rivka were told that shnei goyim bevitznech, that they were going to give rise to two nations. But they were found out that the Bechor was going to be Esav. This was even more problematic. Because the Bechor, the firstborn in the family, under normal circumstances, was the one who most immediately had the relationship with the parents, and was naturally going to be the one who would receive that bracha. The Torah says that there is halacha of pishnayim, that a Bechor inherits more than others under normal circumstances. But even more than that, Ramban points out, and others, that here we weren't speaking about Yerusha. They hadn't entered the land of Israel yet. But somehow it was assumed that the bracha that the father would transmit to the son would go to the Bechor as well as others. And here you find that not only was a Shnei Goyim Bevitznech, but even more so, the Bechor was Esau and the younger one was Yaakov. And immediately the Torah tells us, V'rav Yavod Sa'ir, that the Bechor, the one who is older, is going to serve the younger one. In this case, the roles will be reversed. It will be Yaakov who will receive this bracha, and not Esau. And then the Torah tells us how this divine plan was revealed. How was it that Yaakov was able to get the Bechor, the birthright? And how was it that Yaakov was able to secure the brachos, the blessings, from his father Yitzchak? The Torah seems to paint a somewhat disturbing picture. At first glance, you get the impression that had it been up to Yitzchak, he would have been perfectly satisfied with giving everything he had to his son Esau. And then it was necessary for Rivka to intervene and to disguise Yaakov to look like Esau, and thereby trick their father into securing the bracha. That's the picture which the Torah paints. It seems so difficult for us to imagine. Avraham had such a dream, and Yitzchak was aware of the dream. He knew the character of Yaakov, and he knew the character of Esau. The Torah tells us that Esau was an Ish Tzayid, Ish Sadeh. He was a warrior, he was a man of the field. Yaakov was an Ish Tam, Yosheb Ahali. He was a calm person, dedicated to Torah study. Seems so disturbing that without the intervention of Rivka, the result would have been that Ki v'Yitzchak Yikar l'chazera meant that the message which Avram gave to Yitzchak would be transmitted to Esau, and Yaakov would be left with nothing. It's hard to imagine. Should you try to tell me that Yitzchak was unaware? Yitzchak didn't know the character of his two sons. He didn't realize that Yaakov was the tzaddik that he was. And he didn't realize that Esau was the warrior. For Rashi points out that Esau, even though he acted in this wild fashion of an Ish Tzayid, he did so outside of the house. When he came home, he tried to be as frum as everyone else. That's how he appeared to his father. So maybe you'll tell me that from Yaakov's perspective, Yitzchak thought that both of them were religious, both of them were fine boys, and the Bechor Esav deserves everything. It seems in the Torah itself that it's not true. Yitzchak realized that something was happening when he thought that Esav was appearing before him, and really it was Yaakov. What did he say? The Hakol Kol Yaakov, V'hayadayim Adei Esav. Yitzchak says, it seems very perplexing. Physically, it appears to be my son Esau. But spiritually, his whole contact, his whole demeanor, his whole character seems to be that of Yaakov. The call, the voice which I'm hearing is not the voice of Esau. Rashi explains, what does that mean? That in the previous pasuk, when Esau says, how are you? How did you come so fast? Yaakov says, Baruch Hashem. All of a sudden he says, I blew it. He says, my father didn't know right away that this is not Esau. He's Mazkir Shem Shamayim. He was speaking in a soft tone. He was speaking in a comforting voice. He was praising God and praising his father. So Yaakov knew that something was up. He already realized that perhaps this isn't Esau. So the Torah clearly tells us that he knew the difference between his two sons. He knew that Yaakov was of his character, that he was the Ish Tam Yoshev Aholim. He knew that Esav was the Ish Tzayid Ish Sadeh, which makes it all the more difficult if that's the case. Why is any trickery required? How in the world was it possible for Yitzchak to honestly give this bracha to his son Esav? The Beis Halevi has the following comment. He writes, it's true that Yaakov was willing to give the bracha to Esau. But he writes, take a look at the text of the bracha. Right? This was the bracha that Yitzchak was willing to give to his son Esau. A father is about to die. He has inherited from his father the whole Jewish tradition. He turns to his son on his deathbed and says, Yitin lecha Elokim, Yital HaShemayim v'shmanei haaretz. God should give you dew of the heaven, the fat of the earth. You can have a house and you can have a car. This isn't the normal type of bracha that you would expect Yitzchak to give. So this is what the Beis Halevi says, very simply. It's true. Yitzchak was willing to give the bracha to Esau. But you shouldn't think for a minute we're speaking about giving his son, Esav, the bracha that he inherited from his father. That bracha was not given until the very end of Parshas Toldos. And that Yitzchak never for a moment thought that he was about to give to Esav. He knew the bracha of the Jewish heritage, and the Jewish tradition which he got from his father, there were no doubts. that bracha would only go to Yaakov. But Yitzchak, for better or for worse, felt the following. I have another son. He is Esau. Why should he go without anything? At least, Yitzchak Nochal Elokim Mital HaShemayim Mishmani HaAretz. Let me give him a bracha. Let me give him a bracha of wealth and some happiness. At least physical benefits. I know that the spirituality that I have received from my father cannot be his. And Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim, that is the type of person who will perpetuate a Jewish heritage. A fighter, a warrior, an Ish Tzayid, Ish Sadeh, he cannot. But at least let him get something. The Beis Halevi points out the student thing, that Yitzchak was completely naive. He knew the characters of his children very well. He knew that the main blessing that he received from Avraham, that would be given to Yaakov without question. And that happens at the end of the parsha. However, he felt at least Esau should attain something. Spirituality, that will be Yaakov. But the physical pleasures and benefits from this world, let me give that to the son Esau. And Rivka even objected to that.
But why would Yaakov not be satisfied with what his father intended to do? Why would he want to have the prophet?
Right, so this, the Beis Halevi continues, is where Rivka intervened. Rivka felt, and there's an amazing medrash which seems to be understood in this light, that this is an impossibility. There are many religions that believe in a very ascetic way of life. That people who are, so to speak, spiritual people, people who are committed to the belief, their job is to have no pleasure from this world. All pleasures, all those things that you consider to be mundane, that's for the masses. But the people who are Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim, those people are only obligated to lead a spiritual life. And the Gemara tells us in Nedarim and Daf Yud that this is wrong. But why is it that the Gemara asks that when a person becomes a Nazir, a person decides, I will be a Nazir and therefore I will not drink wine, I won't cut my hair, I won't come in any contact with something that is tameh. Why does that person bring a karbon? Why is that person obligated to bring a sacrifice as if he committed a sin? So the Gemara says, because a nazir is eino ela chote. A person who becomes a nazir is committing a sin. Mitoch shetzir atzmo min hayayin. Because he is depriving himself from those things that God gave us to take advantage of and to enjoy. And the Gemara says, im tziras hayayin kach. If this is true of a nazir who just deprives himself from a particular enjoyment, how much more so is this true of people who attempt to lead a life of starvation, deprivation, of only receiving, so to speak, spiritual enjoyment and spiritual pleasures? This, the Beis Halevi says, was what Rivka was troubled by. You can't have a religion that has such a split. You can't create that type of dichotomy that the masses will lead a physical life, tal hashamayim mishmanei ba'aretz, and those select few, they will have the birchas Avraham. The success and what Jewish belief and tradition demands of us is a fusion, it's a synthesis of these two brachas. You have to have a bracha of the ruchnias, of spiritual belief, of spiritual pleasures, the bracha of Avraham. But it can't be divorced from playing an active role in society and benefiting in a physical sense as well. This is what Rivka objected to. You can't give Esav one bracha and give Yaakov another. In order for the Jewish religion to survive, and in order for us to understand what is it that God demands of us, you have to be able to take both brachas and combine them in a single personality. The ability of the Jewish person to take the physical world and to elevate it, to make it spiritual, to see greatness in every physical act, not merely in a person who is cloistered and completely removed from society. This was the intervention of Rivka. And this required that scheme. It wasn't, though, you should think, that Yaakov was willing to give everything to Esau. Yaakov felt it was possible to make that distinction. However, Rivka felt that it shouldn't, and the Devar Hashem, divine will, was that Rivka was correct. Our job is not to become a Nazir, not to merely be satisfied with our spiritual growth, but involvement in the world is crucial, because that's what God demands of us. The commandments that address both a ben adam lechavero as well as a ben adam lemakom. With this, the Beis Halevi explains a difficult medrash. The medrash tells us, and Parshas told us, that Rivka said, "Kachli shtei gediyei izim tovim." Take two animals, take two goats, bring them to me, and with this, you will be able to get both brachas. So the Midrash comments that the Torah says, "Shtei gediyei izim tovim," that these are considered to be izim tovim, good goats. What does that mean? So the Midrash comments, "Tovim lecha, v'tovim lebonecha," that these two goats which you take are good for you, but they will also be good for your children. Tovim lecha, you will derive benefit from it because ayadeya matanot lesabrachos, because through these animals, you will be able to secure both brachos. And tovim levanecha, how will they be good for your descendants? Because these two animals symbolize atonement. Because the two animals which Yitzchak, which Yaakov brought to Rivka and were given to Yitzchak, are symbolic of the two animals that are used on Yom Kippur, the Seir LaHashem and the Seir LaAzazel, the animal which is sacrificed in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the most holy place, and the animal which is LaAzazel, which is sacrificed in the wilderness. That's what the Midrash tells us. These two animals were very good for Yaakov. They secured the two brachos for him. But symbolized in these two animals are the two animals used on Yom HaKippur. So what exactly is that message? What exactly is this connection between the Shtei Gediyei Izim of Yitzchak, Rivka, and Yaakov, and the Shtei Seirei Izim that are used on Yom HaKippur? So the Beis Halevi points out that this is the point. The thought of Yaakov is that spiritual and physical domains are separate. And Rivka said this is not true. It's not enough to have that Birchas Avram of spirituality, but you also have to have the Bracha of Tal HaShemayim Mishmanei Haaretz. And this is true of Yom HaKippurim as well. When it comes to Yom Kippur, that holy hallowed day of the year, we strive to attain atonement. In order to attain kapara, in order to attain atonement, the Torah tells us that there is a process of shnei se'irim. Where are they sacrificed? One is in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Sanctum Sanctorium, and the Kapores, and the other in the Midbar. The Beis Halevi writes that these two Se'irim of Yom Kippur symbolize these two brachas. That which is most spiritual is reflected in the Se'ir LaHashem. An animal who is sacrificed, who is offered in the Kodesh HaKadoshim once a year on the Kapores. But yet, that is not enough to secure kapara, to attain atonement. In order to attain atonement from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's not enough to have the Seir LaHashem you also have to have a Seir La'azazel. You have to have an animal who was sacrificed in the Midbar. A Midbar for us reflects that which is most desolate, that which is most mundane, furthest thing in the world from a place of spirituality. We understand why you need a Seir LaHashem, why you have an avoda, a service which is done in the most holy of places. But why is it necessary to have a service which is performed in the Midbar? The Beis HaLevi writes precisely this point. Rivka was teaching us a message that in order for us to follow the will of God, it is necessary to synthesize, to fuse both of these areas. Not to be satisfied with Tala Shamayim Mishmani Haaretz, with physical pleasures, but also not merely to strive for spiritual goals. We have to attempt to do both. To take that which God gives us, to elevate it to a heightened level of sanctity. Not to be apart from the world, but to be a part of the world. To actively involve ourselves in the world in order to be able to transform what is otherwise mundane, what is otherwise desolate, into a spiritual place. This, he writes, is the message of Yom HaKippurim. If you want to secure atonement, it's not enough only to have a Seir LaHashem. You have to have a Seir LaAzazel. And this is what the Medrash tells us. That these two animals which you brought are tovim lecha, they're good for you because in them, you get two brachas. The Birchas Avram of spirituality, the bracha of Tal HaShemayim Mishmani Haaretz, of physical benefits. And Tovim Levonecha, this secures atonement for future generations. For every generation that you have a Beis HaMikdash, Kapara, atonement is attained through these two channels, through a Seir LaHashem, and also through a Seir LaAzazel. And this is the message that Beis HaLevi writes of Yom HaKippur. It's important to understand, in terms of the avodah of Yom Kippur, what is the significance of this Seir LaAzazel. The Gemara tells us, even many years ago, that the Seir LaAzazel was always a source of tremendous antagonism, tremendous anti-Semitic response. The whole term scapegoat, that comes from the Seir LaAzazel. That you have a goat that is thrown into the wilderness, and somehow atonement is attained at the expense of others. But the Gemara tells us in Yuma that Umos HaOlam Mekatrin Aleha, that the non-Jews pick on the Jews because of the mitzvah of Seir HaMishtaleach, as if to say that we believe in a Christian notion of vicarious atonement. That in order to get kapara, in order for a person to be absolved of his sins, all he has to do is place the sins on the back of another. You don't have to do tshuva, you don't have to repent, you don't have to feel sorry for your actions, but simply tshuva, kapara can be attained through a Seir LaAzazel, through a scapegoat. The Gemara tells us that's the furthest thing from the truth. Vicarious atonement is very much a Catholic doctrine, but we believe it's certainly not true. We believe the Gemara tells us in Yuma and in Shavuos that Zevach Rishayim Toeva. A person brings a sacrifice and doesn't sincerely feel remorse, doesn't do tshuva, doesn't repent, so the korban is puzzled, not kosher. It doesn't affect any change. That is not the message of the Seir LaAzazel. What is the message? One of them, the Beis Levi points out, is the same message of the brachos that you find in Parshas Toldos. The necessity of combining a Birchas Avram together with the bracha of Tal HaShemayim Mishmani Haaretz. There are similar messages as well that you find. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik once commented that somehow when you speak to people, they'll tell you the difficulty of leading a religious life. They tell you that after all, there's so much sacrifice which is involved. It means changing a particular lifestyle. and it means living in a certain kind of way. It may be at a professional expense. It may be a social expense. It may be simply an expense of time that you have to do other things that you enjoy. That's certainly true. A religious way of life is one which has sacrifice. There's no doubt. But you shouldn't think, once pointed out, that that's only true of religious way of life. You shouldn't think that leading a non-religious life, a secular life, is one which is free of sacrifice. A non-religious life has tremendous sacrifice as well. And at times, we know, sacrifice is much greater on the other side. It may be that a person immediately feels that it's easier day to day, but in the long run, somehow, when you look at what a person accomplishes, and you look at very often the family and the children, you find that there's a tremendous sacrifice in leading a non-religious life as well. He once pointed out that this perhaps is the significance of the Sir La Hashem, the Sir La Azazel. You have two animals that are used on Yom Kippur. Both are sacrificed. Both ways of life, whether one which is more spiritual or one which is more mundane, both involve challenges, both involve difficulties, both involve sacrifices. The difference, he pointed out, however, is what do the sacrifices accomplish? A person leads a religious way of life, it is true, it is one that is full of sacrifice. It's not easy. But when the sacrifice occurs, the result is that you become closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The blood which is spilt of the Sir La Hashem is spilt in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the most holy of places, the place where we believe the divine presence is most profoundly felt. The Sir La Azazel, that which symbolizes that which is more mundane, that also involves sacrifice. But the sacrifice is not in a mikdash, the sacrifice is not in a Kodesh HaKadoshim, the sacrifice is in a midbar, in a wilderness of desolation. It's an important message to keep in mind. It's not easy, but the rewards are great. It involves sacrifice. But at least you're sacrificing for a most noble cause, a Sir La Hashem, not sacrificed La Azazel. And there seems to be, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik pointed out, even a further message. And that is that some believe, and are very convinced, that what a person's character is, what a person's disposition is, are simply determined. They believe in a philosophy of determinism, of fatalism, and that is that whatever has already been planned will occur. There's very little that a person can do to change it. Some people, their inclination is to do good. Others are inclined to do bad. And a person has very little to say in what actually he does. This is not true. It may be that people have a different character. It may be easier for some and more difficult for others. But our belief in free choice and free will tells us that a person has an ability to change. The Mishnah tells us in Yuma that the two animals that you take, the Seir La Hashem and the Seir La Azazel, have to be identical. They have to be Shavim Bekoma and Shavim Bemare. They have to be exactly alike. They have to be twins. To demonstrate that you can have two that are identical, but yet their destiny is so different. One is La Hashem, the other is La Azazel. Just as you find, as the Midrash tells us, the connection of Yaakov and Esau. You can have Shnei Goyim Bevitneh. You can have twins that are born, both having the same parents, both born under the same conditions. Two individuals who genetically are almost perfectly matched. And yet, you can have an Esau, and you can have a Yaakov. You can have a Sir La Hashem, you can have a Sir La Azazel. This is the message of Parshas Toldos. The Midrash tells us the message of Yom HaKippurim. It may be easier for some, more difficult for others, but ultimately, the choice is our own. When it comes to this notion of Bechira, of free choice, there is a very important point that Rabbeinu Bachaya makes. He writes, just as you find with the Seir LaHashem and the Seir LaAzazel, it is true that there is free choice. Just because you have a twin does not assure that the outcome of each one of their lives will be the same. However, free choice, he writes, does not mean that any given moment a person can simply get up and change his way. Possible. You see people who have been living a life in a certain manner, and one morning they wake up and everything is different from that point on. However, Rabbeinu Bachaya writes that normally speaking, that type of choice is almost impossible. He writes that there are certain key moments in a person's life when a person is at a crossroad where a decision has to be made. And that decision is a moment of Bechira. That's a moment of choice. And you have to realize it as that. But sometimes once that decision is made, certain things naturally fall into place and you almost lose your sense of free will. When a person makes a very important decision, where to live, what type of school to go to, what type of community to live in, what type of friends to have, what type of peers to have, it's a very crucial decision. Once that decision is made, certain things automatically begin to snowball. If a person decides to live in an area where there's no synagogue, where there's no religious school, so as a result, a process is set in motion. And it makes Bechira almost impossible. It's true that they can have children living in that area and they can some one day turn around and completely turn about and do everything differently. But the normal process, Rabbi Yochai points out, is to recognize those crucial moments. He writes that when Paro, for example, decided to enslave the Jewish people, that was a moment of choice. But once you make a decision to enslave a nation, certain things are going to follow. What will follow is that you want the nation to work under you, and that you're going to start to abuse them, and you're going to start to mistreat them, and that every moment you get, you're going to try to secure them as your slaves. And that's why Vayiksha Shem eslave Paro. But sometimes Paro was not acting out of free choice, but originally a conscious free choice decision was made. This is also an important message of the Seir LaHashem and Seir LaAzazel. That even though they both started out the same, they ended up so different, one LaHashem, one LaAzazel, it was a single act, the Mishnah tells us, which determined their outcome. Taraf Bakalfi, the Kohen, picked the lot, and that lot determined this one is LaHashem, and this one is LaAzazel. Rabbi Abachaya points out always to realize there are certain decisions that you have to make in your life, and sometimes they're hard to recognize, which are so crucial that is a moment that you have to consider and exercise free choice. Because once that decision is made, it makes free choice almost impossible afterwards. You can change, it's possible, but it's most difficult. These are some of the messages we believe in what the Midrash is driving at. You see the challenge of Yaakov and Esau. The necessity that Rivka said, that our faith believes in a fusion and a synthesis of both domains. We're not to see the bracha of spirituality of Tal HaShemayim and Shemani Haaretz independent of the physical benefits, but our job is to try to fuse, to try to combine, to be able to be active in the world for what we believe in, not apart from the world. And this is what Rivka was able to secure, that Yaakov, not Esau, would get both brachos. This is the message of Kapara, of Atonement and Yom HaKippurim. It's not enough to have a Seir LaHashem, you also have to have a Seir LaAzazel. Both of those are necessary. What appears on the surface to be purely spiritual, and that which appears to be most mundane, to combine those, Like that is where you really attain the bracha of Avraham. This is the message that Yitzchak and Rivka together tried to impress upon their son Yaakov. And this is our task as descendants of Yaakov, to be able to bridge that gap, to emphasize both as well as Mishmanei Haaretz.
Sure. Don't give me a rest. Don't give me a rest. I mean, we'll have to find.
Wait another minute.
Huh?
Wait another minute. Is it running?
Yeah. Because it's a double tape. You know, it turns by itself.
Okay, so wait a minute. Maybe.
You want to wait another minute?
Yeah.
All right, no interruptions.
There's another mitzvah that I wanted to begin discussing this evening. This is a mitzvah which is discussed in the Gemara in Yuma on Daf Pei Aleph, and this is called the mitzvah of Tosefes Yom HaKippurim, Shabbos and Yom Tov. This is the obligation which we have of extending Yom Kippur, Shabbos and Yom Tov, to begin it early and to end late. The Gemara says that this is based on a particular pasuk which we find. This Gemara is in Yuma and Daf Pei Aleph from the Beis. The Gemara says that this is based on a particular pasuk which we find. This Gemara is in Yuma and Daf Pei Aleph from the Beis. The Torah tells us, "Ve'inisim es nafsho seichem." A person is obligated to afflict himself on Yom Kippur. "Vatish lachodesh ba'erev," on the ninth of the month at night. So the Gemara is bothered by this phrase. We know that Yom Kippur really begins on the 10th of Tishrei. So why is it the Torah tells us that you are to begin the festival of Yom Kippur on the 9th toward evening? So the Gemara says we see from this a very important principle, Mikan Shemosifin Mechol Al HaKodesh. From here we see that a person is obligated to begin Yom HaKippurim early. You can't wait until the last minute when actually it's the 10th day. But a person must begin fulfilling all the halachas of Yom Kippur even earlier in the day. And the Gemara says, "V'nismus nafsho seichem batish lachodesh ba'erev, may erev ad erev." What is true on the beginning of Yom Kippur is also true of the end of Yom Kippur. So therefore, the Gemara tells us that there is an obligation, min ha-Torah, a biblical obligation to begin Yom Kippur early, and to end Yom Kippur late. We know this simply because the Torah says, begin Yom Kippur already on the 9th, when it is not yet the 10th. And the Gemara points out clearly that this is a biblical obligation. The Gemara says, in Yuma and Daf Pei Aleph Amud Aleph, if a person eats, or a person does malach on Yom Kippur, the Torah says that there is a particular punishment. What happens if a person eats or does malacha during this beginning time? It's not yet the 10th, but it's that period on the 9th toward the 10th when a person begins Yom HaKippurim. So the Gemara quotes a pasuk to tell us that there is no punishment for that. V'nisim es nafsho seichem tatish l'chodesh. That's true. You should begin early. However, kol asher lo se'uneh be'etzem hayom hazeh. Whoever doesn't observe the halachas of Yom Kippur properly, be'etzem hayom hazeh, in the midst of the day, what does that mean? Al tzumo shoyom onesh kares, v'i'ata onesh kares al hatosefes. Any punishment the Torah mentions for failing to fulfill the mitzvahs of Yom Kippur only applied to Yom Kippur proper, does not apply to that beginning period or that ending period which you are extending. But the Gemara says it is clearly an obligation min ha-Torah, not to wait until the very last minute when Yom Kippur begins, but to begin Yom HaKippurim earlier. And this is a biblical obligation. The Gemara says this in Beitza as well, on Daf Lamed. The Gemara says that there were people who were not careful about this particular mitzvah. They didn't used to begin Yom Kippur early. They used to just begin Yom Kippur at the normal time. And the Chachamim felt it was better not to tell them about this. They didn't make a big deal. Why not? Because the Gemara quotes a principle which is called Mutav Shihei Shogigim Va'al Yuhu Mizidim. It's a very important principle for us to be aware of. If a person is doing something which is wrong, unintentionally, the person isn't aware of this problem. He doesn't know that it's wrong. And we feel that if you inform him of it, he'll continue to do it anyway. You're not allowed to tell him about it. It's a prohibition, it's an isser for you to even mention it to him. Because up until now, he's been doing it inadvertently. He doesn't know that it's wrong. So if by going over to him and telling him the proper way that this is forbidden, he'll stop doing it, that's fine. But if by going over to him and telling him it's forbidden, he'll continue to do so, so the musr which you have given him is not making him any greater, it's making him much worse. That before he was violating something b'shogeg, inadvertently, and now he's doing it, even knowing about it. So the Gemara says it's something really to keep in mind. The Gemara says in Beit Sandaf Lamed that if a person is doing something wrong, if you think you can accomplish something by telling them about it, so then by all means do so. Do it in a kind way, don't do it in an antagonistic way. Anyway, so it's forbidden for you to do such a thing. By telling him to do it, right, you are taking what is not considered to be a terrible sin on his part and making it into a much worse sin. What he's doing b'shogeg, now you're making the maze, and the Gemara says you're not allowed to do that. So the Gemara quotes a particular case, and this is Tosefes. There were some people that didn't need to start Yom Kippur early. And the Chachamim felt, you know, maybe it's better not to tell them, because these people, they felt, if they told them about it, maybe they wouldn't listen. In which case, let them just not do it inadvertently, rather than know about it and still continue their practice. The Gemara says that you see from here that this principle of mutav sheshogig and va'ayu v'nizid, and better let someone continue doing something without knowing about it. Yeah, a lot of them take it out. So then the Gemara says the following. In the El Yom HaKippur, the Torah only has a verse when it comes to Yom Kippur. The Torah says Yom Kippur is to begin on the 9th. Shabbosos v'yom tovim minayin. How do we know that this obligation applies not only on Yom Kippur? Yeah, a lot of them take it out. So then the Gemara says the following. Ein li'el Yom HaKippur. The Torah only has a verse when it comes to Yom Kippur. The Torah says Yom Kippur is to begin on the 9th. Shabbosos v'yom tovim minayim. How do we know that this obligation applies not only on Yom Kippur, but on Shabbos and Yom Tov as well? Because the conclusion of the Pasuk, the Gemara says, V'nisim esnaf shoseichem v'tish l'chodesh me'erev ad'erev. A person is obligated to begin all the halachos of Yom Kippur on the 9th, and extend it late into the 10th, and tishvesu shabbatchem. And this is true on every day of rest. Komakom shne'amar shvos. Anytime we have an obligation to refrain on a Shabbos or on a Yom Tov, mikan shemosif and mechol al kodesh, a person is obligated to begin those times early. So this is what the Gemara tells us in Yuma, that a person has to begin Yom Kippur early, and this is not only true of Yom Kippur, but a person is obligated to begin Shabbos and to begin Yom Tov early as well. This is in fact originally one of the reasons that you have the tefillah of Kabbalah Shabbos. Kabbalah Shabbos is not a formal tefillah. What it is really is an acceptance of Shabbos. And the original custom was that Kabbalah Shabbos was always said before sunset. After sunset already, it's Shabbos for anyone. So if we have a mitzvah to begin Shabbos early, so we do so by reciting a tefillah of Kabbalah Shabbos. And normally speaking, the old minhag was that Kabbalah Shabbos was always recited before sunset. Because after sunset, it's already Shabbos. That's why the minhag was established. In most communities today, it's very difficult. It's hard to start davening so early. And if you do so, you're going to have to end up waiting a long time to daven Maariv. So very often, Kabbalah Shabbos is after sunset. But nonetheless, a person should realize there is an obligation of beginning Shabbos and Yom Tov early. The obligation of beginning Yom Kippur early, as I mentioned, is certainly a biblical commandment. Yeah, but you actually have to begin Shabbos early. Preparing for Shabbos on Fridays, that's a separate mitzvah. That's called Kavod Shabbos. The Karas L'Shabbos, on the Kedosh Hashem Achubad, means there's a mitzvah of Kavod Shabbos. And as we'll discuss in later weeks, Kavod means preparation that you do not on Shabbos, but before Shabbos. A person bathes, a person dresses, a person sets the table. That's called Kavod Shabbos. But then aside from that, there's a mitzvah that you have to begin actual Shabbos early. You can't wait until sunset. You have to begin Shabbos before sunset. So the mitzvah of beginning Yom Kippur early is certainly a biblical obligation. That's clear. What about this obligation of beginning Shabbos and Yom Tov early? Is this a biblical obligation or is it not? So this is not stated explicitly in the Gemara, and this is a major debate among the Rishonim and the early commentaries of the Gemara. There is one view, Dor Zeruah, who writes that just like the obligation of beginning Yom Kippur is an obligation min HaTorah, that's true of every Shabbos and Yom Tov as well. There's a biblical commandment to begin Shabbos and Yom Tov early. Where do we see that this is true? How do you know it's a biblical obligation? So he writes simply that the Gemara says in Brachos and Daf Chavav that Rav Tzali shall erev Shabbos, the Shabbos from HaKadosh. Rav used to daven early on Friday night. Right? During the summer months, for example, sunset's very late, so he daven a little bit earlier. And the Gemara says, not only did he daven early, but he used to make Kiddush. So we learned a few weeks ago that making Kiddush is an obligation, min HaTorah. That's a biblical obligation. The Pasuk says, Zachar es yom HaShabbos l'kadsha. So therefore, there is a rule writes that we have a biblical obligation of making Kiddush. And Kiddush has to be made on Shabbos. But yet, the Gemara says that you can make Kiddush even before sunset, what we do over the summer. You can daven at 7 o'clock, and you come home at 7:30, at 8 o'clock, you make Kiddush, even though it's not yet sunset until 8:30. And yet you fulfill the obligation. How is that possible? It must be, he writes, that there is a biblical obligation to begin Shabbos early, just like we begin Yom Kippur early. So therefore, once a person davens, it is now considered to be Shabbos for him, and therefore you can make Kiddush early. And he tries to prove from here, you see, it's a biblical commandment. There are others who disagree with this. But we assume, right, it says in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Reish Samach Aleph, that there is an obligation that a person begin Yom Kippur, and begin Shabbos, and begin Yontif early. How early is early? It's not clear in the Gemara. It says in Shulchan Aruch that even if it's just a few minutes, that's all that is necessary. Sunset is at 6 o'clock. So you can't wait until 6 o'clock. A person should stop a few minutes at least before 6 and explicitly state that they are now accepting upon themselves the sanctity of Shabbos. Women, for example, who always light candles, so they don't have to do this. That is one of the purposes of candle lighting. That if a woman will light candles, the custom is 18 minutes before sunset. If a woman will light candles, and she will have in mind that by lighting candles that it is now Shabbos, so therefore, she not only fulfills the mitzvah of candle lighting, but she fulfills this mitzvah of Tosefta Shabbos, that she is beginning Shabbos early. Okay, it's important to keep that in mind, because this is an obligation in which both men and women are obligated in, that you can't wait until the last minute to accept Shabbos, but you have to begin Shabbos early. See, candle lighting, we'll discuss in a few weeks. There is a question among the Rishonim what candle lighting accomplishes. There's one view who says that candle lighting, by definition, is automatic acceptance of Shabbos. Once you light candles, automatically it's Shabbos. Not only for the person who lights, but for the entire household. And that's why, even though normally speaking, you always make a bracha before you do a mitzvah, before you hold the luv and esrog, you make a bracha. Before you eat matzah, you make a bracha. With candle lighting, we don't do that. Because the one view, the halachos gedolos writes, that once you recite a bracha, that lahadlik ner shel Shabbos, automatically it becomes Shabbos. And therefore, afterwards you can't do any malacha. That's the view of the halachos gedolos. Candle lighting, by definition, means it is now Shabbos for the person who lights and for the entire household. The Ramban, however, disagrees. The Ramban writes, candle lighting does not necessarily make it Shabbos. Just like a person bathes on Friday, just like a person wears nice clothing, sets the table, you prepare for Shabbos to come, one of the methods of preparation is to light candles. But preparation does not entail an acceptance of Shabbos. So the Ramban writes, it is possible to light candles, and even after you light candles, you can do anything you want. One difference between the two of them is, after you light candles, can you do any malacha? Another difference between the Bahag and the Ramban is, what do you do first on Shabbos Hanukkah? The Bahag writes, you have to light the menorah first. Because once you light the Ner Shabbos, automatically, it's Shabbos. You can't light the menorah any longer. The Ramban says that's not true. Lighting Shabbos candles does not make it Shabbos. And therefore, he says, what the preferred practice is, he writes, is to light the Ner Shabbos first. Because whenever you have two mitzvot that you have to perform, and you want to know which one to do first, so the Gemara has a principle of Tadir Rishino Tadir Tadir Koda. Whatever mitzvah is most commonly fulfilled, whatever mitzvah you do most often, do that one first. The Ramban writes, there are different practices, different customs is what to do. Ramban writes, first light the Shabbos candles, because that you do every week. And then light the Ner Chanukah that you do once a year. And the Bahag says, no, that you can't do, because once you light the Shabbos candles, it becomes Shabbos. How do we assume in Shulchan Aruch? So if you look in Shulchan Aruch, and Siman Reish Samach Gimel, it writes that technically speaking, lighting candles is not considered to be an acceptance of Shabbos. However, what is mentioned in Shulchan Aruch is, we assume the following, but it need not necessarily be so. We assume the following, that normally when a woman lights, usually it's the last thing that she does. Therefore, we assume that when a woman lights candles, it is automatically Shabbos for her. When a man lights candles, usually a man will do it before he goes to shul. So usually he still has in mind that it's not yet Shabbos, because he knows he's going to go to shul, and he's going to go daven. So normally speaking, if you don't have anything in mind, we assume when a woman lights, it is Shabbos for her. When a man lights, it is not Shabbos for him, just because in their normal course of events, that's what normally happens. But it doesn't have to be that way. A man can light candles having in mind that it's Shabbos, and in turn, a woman can light candles having in mind that it is not yet Shabbos. Right? If a woman has to light candles now, let's say she wants to go to shul, she's going to drive to shul, she's going to carry to shul, right? A common practice on Kol Nidre, for example, where all women certainly go to shul, you can light candles at home, have in mind that it is not yet Yom Kippur, and then drive to shul, carry to shul. That you can certainly do. The Gemara in Erev and Daf Mem makes one stipulation, and that is that there's another bracha that you recite on Yom Kippur. That's the bracha of Shehecheyanu. Now the bracha of Shehecheyanu, we'll have to discuss this in later weeks, but that is not a bracha on candlelighting. Because the Gemara says that you only make a bracha of Shehecheyanu on mitzvos which are eino tadira, a mitzvah that you only fulfill once in a long while. How often do you pick up a lulav? Once a year? Make a bracha. How often do you hear the shofar? Once a year? Make a bracha. How often do you read the Megillah? Make a bracha of Shehecheyanu. A mitzvah that you do every week, you don't recite a Shehecheyanu on. So therefore, the Shehecheyanu which women recite during Hadlakas HaNeiros, or men recite during Kiddush, it's not on the mitzvah of Kiddush. It's not on the mitzvah of lighting candles. It's on the sanctity of Yontif. Because the sanctity of Yontif is something which requires a bracha of Shehecheyanu. So therefore the Gemara says that in order to recite a bracha of Shehecheyanu on Yontif, it has to be either at a time that it is Yontif, on Yontif proper, or on a time where you accept upon yourself the Yontif. So let's say an Erev Yontif, a woman is lighting candles, and she has in mind that with this candle lighting it is now Yontif for me. So then she can recite the bracha not only on candle lighting, but also the bracha of Shehecheyanu. But let's say Kol Nidre night, a woman will light candles, having in mind specifically that it's not yet Yom Kippur because I want to come to shul, so you can recite the bracha on candle lighting. Because the Ramban says the mitzvah of candle lighting does not automatically make it Shabbos or Yontif for Yom Kippur. But you can't recite a bracha of Shehecheyanu, because Shehecheyanu means it's now Yontif. And that you have to wait until later. On Kol Nidre, you light candles at home, you make the bracha on the hadlaka, then later, after you come to shul, in the course of the davening, a Shehecheyanu is recited by everyone. And that even women should do, unless they have in mind when they light candles that it is now Yom Kippur. So normally speaking, when women light candles, presumably they have in mind that now it's Shabbos. And so that's why the Rama writes that the first thing you do is light. Right? Because once you make the bracha and you have in mind that it's Shabbos, now you can no longer light. So the first thing you do is you light. But the Rama quotes an interesting minhag, and that is that women cover their eyes in order not to derive any benefit from the candles until after the bracha. So this way, you can have it both ways. You can recite the bracha. Really, in essence, it's on before the candle lighting because you're not deriving any benefit from the candles until after the bracha. And yet, even it allows you to recite a bracha, even should you assume that once you make the bracha, it is now Shabbos. So that's the practice which women have. They light first, then they make the bracha covering their eyes, and after the bracha, then they uncover their eyes to derive benefit from the candles that are being lit. So if that's what women do, so then, normally, they not only fulfill the mitzvah of candle lighting, but they also fulfill this obligation of Tosefes Shabbos. A person is obligated to begin Shabbos early. So when are they lighting candles? They're not waiting until after sunset. After sunset, you're not allowed to light candles. You're lighting candles before sunset. Right? The most common minhag is 18 minutes before sunset, but there are other customs, right, to even light before that. So when you light the candles 18 minutes before sunset, should have in mind that not only am I fulfilling a mitzvah of candle lighting, but I'm also fulfilling a commandment of Tosefes Shabbos. By doing so, I'm beginning Shabbos early. let's say a woman should light candles and have in mind it is not Shabbos, or let's say men who are not lighting candles, then they have to have in mind and even enunciate specifically that now they are accepting Shabbos and fulfilling this obligation. And let's say a woman lights candles 18 minutes before sunset, but she wants another few minutes to do something in the house. Or let's say a man is not lighting candles. So some point before Shabbos, at least a few minutes before, 5 minutes before sunset, they should state explicitly, now I'm accepting Shabbos. Because that's a biblical obligation. But we all do it, those who recite that Tefillah on Yom Kippur, everyone does it on Yom Kippur. And women who light candles, they have the best way of fulfilling this mitzvah. They actually do one of the mitzvahs of Shabbos. But again, if a woman lights and has in mind it's not Shabbos, or men who don't light, they have to have in mind specifically, and even at best to say, that now it is Shabbos. This Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that some communities always presents a particular problem. Some places, they daven mincha a little bit late. They daven mincha after sunset. So the Rav pointed out that aside from the normal question of whether you can daven mincha after sunset or not, right? Preferably, we assume in Shulchan Aruch that mincha you should daven before sunset, it presents a more specific problem on Shabbos. Because if you're davening mincha after sunset, so there are two other problems. Problem number one that we discussed last week is that the Yerushalmi says you're not supposed to daven a weekday Shemone Esrei on Shabbos. So once it hits sunset already, it's automatically Shabbos. So in effect, what you're doing is you're davening a weekday Shemone Esrei on Shabbos. And furthermore, Rav Soloveitchik often points out, what happens to the obligation of Tosefes? You have to begin Shabbos early. Early means before sunset. So if at first you're going to start davening mincha a few minutes after sunset, so by the time you get around to accepting Shabbos, it's already too late. So therefore, it's very important to keep this in mind. It's an obligation, either a biblical obligation or a rabbinic obligation, to accept Shabbos and Yontif early. Women who light candles can do so through candlelighting. If they decide to light candles having in mind that it's not yet Shabbos or Yontif, they're not. But men have to explicitly accept Shabbos. So the classic way of doing so is by reciting Kabbalah Shabbos. When I sit down and I say, L'chadodi, or I sit down and I say that Mizmor Shili Yom HaShabbos, that's a Kabbalah Shabbos. That's why some people you'll notice in the synagogue on Friday night have a custom of standing for L'chadodi. For the entire L'chadodi, not just for the last paragraph. Or standing for Mizmor Shili Yom HaShabbos. Because in earlier times, this was the real acceptance of Shabbos. For us, it's only a custom, because certainly, right, in most congregations, by the time they say L'chadodi, it's certainly after sunset. And the mitzvah of Kabbalah Shabbos has to be done beforehand. So people still have a custom that they stand. But if by the time you're going to be getting to Kabbalah Shabbos, it's going to be after sunset, which it is in almost every community, then you have to explicitly accept upon yourself Shabbos. This is true of Yom Kippur, certainly. It's true of every Shabbos. It's true in every Yom Kippur. Often you find it's a mitzvah that women always do. Because women light candles, and they always light candles before sunset, having in mind that now it's Shabbos. So they fulfill this mitzvah. But unfortunately, men mostly run aware of the mitzvah. The Gemara which says in Yuma and Daf Pei Aleph that you have to accept upon yourself Shabbos and Yom Kippur. We assume that there's no clear time period mentioned in the Gemara, as I mentioned. Tosfos writes, based on the Lama, that there's a small time involved, but even a few minutes is sufficient. You can't wait till sunset, a few minutes before sunset to stop, and to say now I'm accepting upon myself Shabbos. In fact, there's an interesting Rashi that you find in Parshas Bereishis. The Rashi points out there seems to be a contradiction between the verses as to when God created the world. But one verse tells us that Sheshes Yimasasem Esa Shemayim V'Esa Oretz, that God created the world in 6 days. And on the seventh day, God rested, didn't create the world. But then Rashi points out there's another pasuk of Vayechal Elokim Vayom HaShvi'i, that God completed creating the world on the seventh day. So Rashi points out, isn't this a contradiction? First we say God created the world in 6 days and then rested. The seventh day he did no act of creation. And then we say in Vayechulu, Vayechal Elokim Bayom HaShvi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu finished on the seventh day. So Rashi quotes two answers. One Rashi says is that on the seventh day, both are true. God created Shabbos. By resting on the seventh day, Ba Shabbos, Ba Menucha, he created the institution of Shabbos. So therefore, he actively created the world in 6 days. On the seventh day, he rested, and thereby, Vayechal Elokim Bayom HaShvi, he created for us the institution of Shabbos. That's one answer that Rashi gives. And then Rashi gives another answer. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows in his divine wisdom exactly when one day ends and when another day begins. So he stopped his work exactly at that cutoff point between the end of the sixth day and the beginning of the seventh day. So in actuality, the world was only created in 6 days, but it appears to us as if it's on the seventh day. Rashi writes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shiyodei Itav Regav, God knows when exactly one day ends and when another day begins. So he stops at that point. But we who don't know exactly when one day ends and when another begins, Tzarech Lahosif Mechol HaKodesh, we have to begin Shabbos early. We can't wait until exactly 6 o'clock. Look in the paper and it says sunset's at 6. We're going to wait exactly until 6 o'clock? That you can't do. We have to begin Shabbos early. So at least a few minutes before sunset, right, a person has to stop and consciously be aware and even articulate that right now it is Shabbos, or right now it's Yom Tov. And this is true not only at the beginning, it's true of the end of Shabbos as well. That when a person looks outside and he sees right now it is dark out, a person should wait a couple more minutes. This is part of the mitzvah of the Torah. Not to start doing malacha, not to make havdalah exactly at the point that you think on the bulletin that it says, now Shabbos is over, but to wait a few minutes, having in mind that this is the mitzvah of Tosefes. But it expresses, the Gemara tells us, that how dear Shabbos is to us. That you can't wait until it's over, and you try to wait as long as you can until it begins. Right? The opposite should be true. That you try to accept it early, and you delay in making havdalah. Because that's how we show that Shabbos for us is something which is loved and something which is dear to us. So this is true, and halacha l'maaseh, we should all be aware of the obligation of beginning early and the obligation of ending Shabbos late. It applies on Yom Kippur, it applies on Shabbos, and it applies on Yom Tov as well. There's a very interesting discussion that you find in Shulchan Aruch in as far as technically how exactly this mitzvah works. There's an obligation of Tosefes. And a person, that means, is obligated to begin Shabbos early. What exactly, conceptually, does that mean? I now begin Shabbos early. Does it really mean that halachically that period is treated as the day of Shabbos? Or is that not really true? Right? It says that sunset is at 6 o'clock on Friday. So at least for a few minutes before 6, I'm obligated to begin Shabbos early. Are those few minutes considered to be the day of Shabbos, or are they not? Because you can understand this in one of two ways. One way to understand it is to argue that when a person accepts upon himself Shabbos, for him it is now called the day of Shabbos. And it has the full Kedushas Hayom, the full sanctity of the day of Shabbos. The other way of understanding is that that's not true. When a person begins Shabbos early, it doesn't have the full thrust of Shabbos. Rather, it means that just like I will not do any labor on Shabbos itself, so I will refrain from those activities even during this preliminary period. But not that it becomes Shabbos. What difference does it make? Whether it is Shabbos, or whether it's not Shabbos, or Shulchan Aruch, we have a very interesting distinction in the halacha that comes up very often. This is found in the very end of Siman Reish Sadi Aleph. That the Gemara tells us in Shabbos and the Kuf Yud Zayin Amud Beis that a person is obligated to have meals on Shabbos. Torah quotes a verse which is found in Parsha Shmos, Sechlu Hayom, Shabbos Hayom LaHashem, Hayom Osim Zuhu Basadeh. A person is supposed to eat on this day because this day is dedicated to God. On this particular day, you should not be found in your fields. So the Gemara says, since ichluhu, eating on this day, is mentioned, Klu Hayom, eat on this day. And since the word Yom, day, is mentioned three times, it is from here that we derive the obligation of Shalosh Sudos, of having three meals. This is what the Gemara says in Shabbos Daf Kuf Yud Zayin. A rabbinic obligation, we generally assume, to have three meals on Shabbos. So it says in Shulchan Aruch the following. The pasuk tells us, Ichlu Hayom, to eat on this day. The meals that you have on Shabbos have to be during the day of Shabbos. So therefore, a very interesting question is discussed in Shulchan Aruch. When a person accepts upon himself Shabbos early, is it really considered to be Yom HaShabbos? Is it really considered to be the full crust of Shabbos? Maybe you could argue that the day of Shabbos really begins after sunset. The Torah tells us there's a mitzvah to begin early. That's a mitzvah to show our appreciation, to show our anticipation, to show our desire that Shabbos should come. So we begin Shabbos early, but Shabbos isn't actually until sunset. Right, that's what the Gemara says. If a person is Mechal Shabbos, that means that he did Melacha on Shabbos proper. If a person does Melacha during that interim period, that preliminary period of Tosefes, it's not called Chilul Shabbos. The person didn't fulfill the mitzvah of extension, but it's not called desecrating Shabbos. So what about the obligation of having this festive meal, Ichlu Hayom? So this comes up all the time. Let's say over the summer months. Sunset is very late. Sunset can be a quarter to nine. And most synagogues will daven early. They'll daven at 7 o'clock. So you daven at 7, and you get home, then you make kiddush at 8, you start having your meal. Can you fulfill the obligation of having a Suda Shabbos during this period? This period is called Tosefes Shabbos. Shabbos really does not begin until sunset. But there is a mitzvah to begin Shabbos early. So it's not only true during the summer. It's true even now when Shabbos is so early, you still have to begin Shabbos early. But during the winter, it's enough to begin a few minutes early. During the summer, it's very convenient to begin Shabbos a couple hours early. Right? The earliest time you can begin Shabbos is an hour and a quarter before sunset. Right? That's the earliest time. So that's very convenient to do. But can you fulfill the obligation of having a Suda Shabbos at that point? This is two opinions of Shulchan Aruch. There is an opinion of the Marshal, and the Marshal writes, you can't. It may very well be that there's a mitzvah to start Shabbos early, and that's what we do at this time of the year, and that's what we do during the summer. But the Marshal says it's not called Shabbos yet. It's not really called the day of Shabbos. So if the Torah says you have to have three meals on the day of Shabbos, that means, he writes, that you have to be careful to have at least a kazayis. You have to have at least part of the meal and have a slice of bread during a time where it's definitely Shabbos. In other words, that if sunset is at 8:30 and you get home from shul at 8 o'clock, so you can make kiddush at 8 o'clock, but you have to make sure that your meal extends into the night in order to call it Ichlu Hayom, a meal on Shabbos. Because even though there's a mitzvah to begin Shabbos early, that doesn't mean you can fulfill the obligation of a suda, of a festive meal, during that time. And the Taz disagrees. That's what many assume the halacha. The Taz writes that's not true. His language is that mis shahosif mechol ha-kodesh, that once a person accepts upon himself Shabbos, kfar halach v'chalach alam chovas hayom v'habi kalayla v'machar mamish. Once a person accepts upon himself Shabbos, halachically it becomes the day of Shabbos already. Doesn't bother me if it's still light outside. As long as it's within that time period, it's a half hour before Shabbos, an hour before Shabbos, once you say, it is now Shabbos for me, it becomes Shabbos. And therefore the Taz writes, you can go home, and you can make Kiddush, and you can have your Suda Shabbos, and you can finish your Shabbos at Suda Shabbos at 8:30 Yilus, and we assume the Halaf and Siman Reis Samachalaf, that means a person is obligated to articulate, to say that I am now accepting upon myself Shabbos. Women who light candles can do it with candle lighting. If they light candles and have in mind that it's Shabbos, they fulfill their obligation. However, if women should light candles having in mind that it's not yet Shabbos, or men who don't light candles, they have to express explicitly that now I'm accepting upon myself Shabbos at least a few minutes, I'd say 5 minutes before sunset. This was the original reason for Kabbalah Shabbos, that before sunset you welcome Shabbos and declare that it is now Shabbos. But as in most synagogues where Kabbalah Shabbos is recited already later, it's recited after sunset, so this is an obligation that we all have and should be aware of, to accept upon ourselves Shabbos early. Okay, we'll continue next week discussing various other aspects of the Sefer Shabbos and Nefer.
Uh-huh.
You have to see what to do. Good question. Come up on here.